My grandmother said, I think they were wise words, always tell the truth, but don't tell all you know. I think that some of that carried into my pastoral ministry from time to time, and I've brought that with me into the research I've been doing with C.S. Lewis. Let me start with a story. It was about 3 years ago, and I was sitting in McDonald's with my wife, friends of our family, and our children were busy playing in the play place. Staying active, staying busy, and my friend was a therapist, still is a therapist, and we started chatting about our different professions. He was part of our church, and we'd become friends through the years, and the topic of our own work came up, and we asked, he asked me, well, would you, or I asked him, would you have, be friends with your clients? Would you socialize with them? And it was, you know, very clear, like, oh, no, I couldn't do that, and it kind of dawned on him that he was like, I suppose that you're doing this right now, right? And kind of socializing with me. And we kind of laughed about it and was able to have a pastoral moment where we were able to share the difficulty of giving support to your friends. And I think I said something silly and flippant, something like, and it's very difficult when all your friends are losing it. What I should have said was something like, it's difficult to provide spiritual, professional, pastoral support to your friends who are engaged in events that are seemingly disintegrating in their lives, relationally or professionally or spiritually, or something like that. And the reason I should have said something far more couched, far more professional, was that about 18 months later, my wife and I had the opportunity, responsibility, to walk him and his wife through a period of separation. And suddenly in that, my mind is just racing back. Have I said something that has kind of given up the opportunity I've had to be a pastoral presence in his life? Is something that I said trying to be funny or to be flippant or even just to share the ups and downs of pastoral life with a person who was and is my friend, is something I said, did it jeopardize that? Which brings me to some of this tension that if you are pastors, or in spiritual leadership, or in helping professions in some sort, you, I think, have probably experienced it, a tension between self-revelation and pastoral leadership. Maybe asking questions something like this. Will the other person know more about me? If they know more about me, will it ease their pain, anxiety, and isolation? How much of myself do I share? How much vulnerability is appropriate? Can I entrust myself to a person to whom I am a spiritual authority without fear of judgment or maybe discouragement? Will telling about myself threaten to dominate the conversation or create an expectation that my experience is normative for them? Are there other questions that you have had in this tension of self-revelation and leadership that you would want to put on the slide that you can say, this is a question that I have asked in this tension. Any questions that you would add to those?
I think, for myself as a psychotherapist, the question which drives me is this for them or is this for me? Mm-hmm.
Sure, yeah, say more about that. Regulatory bodies.
Well, I practice psychotherapy as well, actually. So just what's expected of your profession.
Okay.
It's going to be different in different types of different denominations, but there will be guidelines and evaluation.
Sure. Is this for them? Is this for me? What are my professional expectations, maybe written, unwritten? A recent book called Emotional Intelligence for Religious Leaders gave a couple of experiences around this topic. A couple of pastors gave these reflections. They said, I guess for me, one of the biggest ways I've been successful in influencing others is just by being real with people. Another pastor said this, you can see the real me if you want to. You don't have to go through a lot of levels. As I started to reflect on this question that I certainly had asked a number of times in my own professional ministry, I suppose that it kind of boiled down to this. Well, what might C.S. Lewis tell me about this challenge? Of course, he's not really around to tweet and to ask him his direct opinion. So I went back to some of my own experience, which, if it's like yours, reading the Chronicles of Narnia, maybe the Space Trilogy, maybe some others of his fiction whenever you are a child or a teen or maybe early on in your pastoral ministry. And I began to reflect on, well, just as my grandmother's phrase, always tell the truth, but don't tell all you know, became embedded in me as something of a norm, something of some wisdom, I wondered, is there some philosophy that Lewis maybe has already given to me around this tension through his fiction? And if there is, can I try to make it more critically aware of it? Can I try and find some wisdom that might pertain to these kinds of questions from his fiction? One of the challenges, of course, of spiritual leadership is that it requires a management of various aspects of the self, our emotional and spiritual burdens. It requires developing habits of authenticity because they are vital to the management of the typical strains of pastoral work. From the book Emotional Intelligence for Spiritual Leaders, West writes, failing to learn the difference between healthy emotional self-control and maladaptive psychological tendencies can be harmful. Our emotions are powerful forces that must be accounted just as we must plan for a power surge in our home in the event of a lightning strike. So they are very much advocating for ways that we can be self-revealing in this time. Maybe looking approvingly at those conversations that I had in McDonald's with my friend. Another voice in this is from Will Willimon, his book Pastor, which has become probably a classic even over the last 20 years, not quite 20 years since its publication. Some of the wisdom that Willimon writes, and he uses the psychology of Carl Jung to describe personas or masks. Willimon writes, the persona is not necessarily an act or a deceitful charade. It helps protect us by keeping parts of ourselves hidden. It's the professional face that we must present or that we present to the world in order to fulfill our responsibilities. The pastor is not necessarily being deceitful when he goes and expresses sympathy for the care of James Smith. The pastor is putting his own personal feelings aside in order to accomplish the greater good of offering pastoral care to a grieving person. So if very briefly West and his co-authors are advocating a sense of self-revelation, Will Willimon is advocating something of a persona, right? Or putting on a role, putting on a mask, which can be a little bit ambiguous. We'll talk more about it as the presentation continues, but certainly another side of wisdom in this question. So, bringing this to Lewis, why might Lewis be a good conversation partner on these questions of tension? Why might he be a good person to access for wisdom? Number one, I began to see the themes of the face and masks very prominently in two of Lewis's key pieces of fiction. First, his first piece of fiction post-conversion was Pilgrim's Regress in 1933. And then his final piece of fiction, co-authored with his wife Joy, this was the final piece of fiction that he published before his death, which was Till We Have Faces. Let me describe these briefly for you. If you haven't read them, then hopefully I won't give enough away that you'll still be able to enjoy them, but maybe with a couple of lenses to read them, at least with this question in mind. So in The Pilgrim's Regress, there's a young boy named John. It describes his experience in his pursuit of God. And very early on, he comes into the contact with a steward, which is another word for pastor. And at first, John finds the spiritual teaching, he finds the steward pleasant and welcoming, until the pastor, the steward, begins to talk about God. Then the steward puts a mask on. Prior to the mask, Lewis describes the man with a red, round face, and describes him as very kind and full of jokes. But prior to speaking of God, or the landlord, the steward took a mask down off his wall with a long white beard on it, attached it, and clapped it to his face so that his appearance was awful. In the steward's coaching of how John should respond to the question of whether he had broken any of God's rules or the landlord's rules, the steward instantly takes off the mask, looks at John with his real face, says Lewis, and said, "Better tell a lie, old chap. Better tell a lie. Easiest for all concerned." And then popped his mask back on all in a flash. To the question of whether or not John had broken any of the rules, he said, "Oh, no, sir. Just as well," said the steward. through the mask. If you did break any of them, the landlord got to know it, well, it would be bad news. And I'll shorten the description there. In Lewis's, later on in Pilgrim's Regress, Lewis will use this language of the face and a veil to describe the work of God or the landlord. In speaking of the metaphor of the veil and the work of mythology, Lewis writes this of the landlord. The landlord says, "But this is my inventing, this mythology. This is the veil under which I have chosen to appear, even from the first until now. For this end, I made your senses, and for this end, your imagination, that you might see my face and live." If you know the story of C.S. Lewis, you understand some of the way that he became, was always appreciative of mythology and how it became such an important avenue for him to come to understand God. Whereas we sometimes think of if there's a presence of mythology that might illuminate some of our own Christian stories or Jewish stories, we think that that might be a threatening thing. For Lewis, he said, that's not all the bad for Christianity. He said, that's all the better for mythology. He said, that's exactly what we should expect, and puts it in these kinds of words. This is God's veil that he was using to draw us to himself so that we might ultimately see his face. So why Lewis? It's a pertinent theme in the early and late fiction. I think I missed... Oh, I'll come to it in a second. I want to tell you about my method as well. So why Lewis? I noticed this presence of the mask and persona and veil in his early fiction and in his late fiction, really standing out as bookends. And then also this curious little passage from George MacDonald, whom Lewis described as his master. Lewis described MacDonald as his master, one from whom he learned so much. And there's a letter that George MacDonald writes to his wife in 1860, and he describes one of the functions of stories like this. He's describing stories that weren't very good because they were missing out on this. He says, as stories, they just want one central spot of red. The wonderful thing which, whether in a fairy story or in a word or a human being, is the life and depth, whether truth or humor or pathos, it's the eye to the face of it, the thing that shows the unshowable. While on its own, this quote might reveal very little, seeing the bookends of Pilgrim's Regress and Till We Have Faces present in Lewis's own writing. And then this quote gave me a hypothesis by which I wanted to consider the Chronicles of Narnia, right? One of Lewis's best known pieces of fiction with this question in mind. So I used a method called... a sensory aesthetic texture, which was looking in the text for ways that it kind of leaps out at us, ways that it kind of attacks us. If you're familiar with the work of New Testament scholar Vernon Robbins, he uses this work quite a bit. It's a way to read text to see how do they impact us? How do they, in a sense, attack us? So I began to use this method by specifically looking for themes of face or language of facial features like eyes, ears, mouth, nose, hair, and their influence on other people. And here is some of what I found. First, in the Chronicles of Narnia, the face is used to reveal a character's inner life, otherwise hidden to other characters, and to reveal a character's true identity when it's in doubt. I'll give you a number of examples through these. I won't give all of them, but no doubt, if you're familiar with the stories, some of them will come to mind for you. So, for example, in Prince Caspian, Caspian's tutor, Cornelius, Caspian is said simply to assume that he is human. He is said to have a very wise, very ugly, yet very kind face. And while the young prince still considers him to be a man, even after Cornelius' teachings about old Narnia, when Cornelius reveals his face clearly, he is recognized as a dwarf, though he is actually part man and part dwarf. Later on, in Voyage of the Dawn Treader, Caspian is on this quest to discover what's happened to friends of his father's who have been banished and left the kingdom whenever his uncle Miraz took over. And at one location, it's said that Caspian is caught and brought to the slave trade. Upon capture, his identity is specifically told to be kept secret. But at the market, Caspian is purchased by the Lord Byrne, who says, quote, "I bought you for your face. Upon revealing his true identity, even in the face of the Lord Burns' semi-doubt, Caspian is challenged as a result on how the Lord Burns should know the truth of his claim to being Caspian. To which Caspian promptly responds, firstly, by my face. Let's turn to Horse and His Boy, where King Loon sees truth in Shasta's story of the impending attack from the Calormenes. He sees truth in Shasta's face. And Shasta's initial review of the king reveals him as his character, truly, where he is seen as an apple-cheeked and twinkling-eyed man to go along with his jolliness. At other points in the Chronicles of Narnia, you'll see that the identity of talking beasts is seen in their face. So Pattertwig is a squirrel whose face looks unlike any other squirrel. And the badger from Prince Caspian as well is described as having a face unlike any other badger that you might see. Another example of this sense of identity being revealed in the face is of Caspian at Deathwater Island in the Voyage of the Dawn Treader. In the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, you might remember Eustace's very memorable encounter when he turns into a dragon. After being turned into a dragon, Eustace actually finally recognizes himself when he sees the dragon face in the pool and recognizes that it is his own reflection. His identity is finally revealed to himself in this dragon face. Lewis actually uses this theme then to carry on to describe who Caspian is. While this encounter that Caspian has with his face, or that that Eustace has with his face, might be taken literally in the story, the dragonish inner life of another character, Caspian, implies that Eustace sees his own character truly when it is revealed in dragon form. Caspian's greed for gold is revealed on Deathwater Island, where he and Edmund squabble for the rights to this island, and where the water turns things to gold. When Caspian begins to realize the riches that belong to the king who owns this island, Lewis writes, his face flushed. There's a dual meaning that could be used of flush, both that he blushed and that he realized he could be well supplied with money. His face flushing brings Caspian's character to his face. Caspian's face reveals his dragonish heart in this scene through two other pieces of evidence. First, the Dawn Treader itself is the finest ship built under Caspian's reign, and it itself is a dragon. And second, Caspian's cabin is said to be decorated with dragons. Finally, where is Caspian transformed from his dragonish self? In his cabin upon seeing the face of Aslan with Aslan's, quote, terrible eyes, from which Caspian emerges with a transformed face, white and full of tears. Whereas the water reflected Eustace's dragonish self in reflection, the water of the island subtly revealed Caspian's dragonish self in his flushed face. So, the face is used to reveal the character's inner life, who they are, which is otherwise hidden to characters, and to reveal a character's true identity when it's in doubt. Secondly, this use of examining the Chronicles of Narnia with its sensory texture in mind, I found that in the Chronicles of Narnia, the face is said to influence others to act, to stop acting, or to confirm that right action has taken place. I'll start with Diggory's face in The Magician's Nephew. Right away in this story, we are told of his face popping over a fence, a face that is wet with tears and quite dirty. We are told soon after that he needed to hold back his tears. It's revealing his internal condition. We're reminded of Diggory's face just before he's commissioned to retrieve an apple to undo the wrong he has brought into Narnia. Because he is desperate for Aslan to do something to heal his own mother, who is deathly ill, we are told that Diggory has a lump in his throat and tears in his eyes. And he finally, after a time, dares to look into the lion's face. And there, what does he see? He sees that the lion has this tawny face bent near to Diggory's own, and that Aslan has his own great shining tears that tell Diggory that Aslan might be sorrier about his mother than even Diggory. And these very tears confirm to Diggory later on that he made the right choice not to use the apple that he was sent to retrieve for his own benefit, though the witch had told him to do so. A second example of this event, or of this finding of the face. Lucy, in The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, is sent upstairs in the magician's house to say a spell that will turn invisible things visible. And so she is going through this rather remarkable and majestic book, magic book, And it says that she comes across a spell to make the utterer beautiful. And in this account, the face is prominent. We are told that she, quote, peers at the pictures with her face close to the page. She sees that one of those pictures is of herself, with her, quote, mouth open and a rather terrible expression on her face. She sees that this pictured Lucy and the real Lucy look into each other's eyes, and the real Lucy looks away, dazzled by the beauty of the other Lucy, though she could still see a sort of likeness to herself in that beautiful face. The result of the spell will be the loss of Susan's beauty as well, and it is said that Susan has a nasty expression on her face as she witnesses all of this going on within the storybook's life. Even so, in spite of all of these warnings, Lucy decides to say the spell, but when she goes to read the words, she found the great face of a lion, the lion, Aslan himself, staring into hers. She, quote, knew the expression of his face quite well. He was growling, and you could see most of his teeth. She became horribly afraid and turned over the page at once. So here we're having a sense of Lucy's identity revealed in her face, and also the effect of Aslan's face to keep her from taking this action. Finally, the face is the locus of transformation in the Chronicles of Narnia. A few examples. First, from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, the witch is said to have a white face that is proud and cold and stern with a very red mouth. Upon eating the witch's food, Edmund is said to have a red face with sticky fingers and mouth. So there's connection of red face and the prominence of the mouth in both these descriptions. The connection of Edmund's transformation at the witch's influence is confirmed by Mr. Beaver, who says that Edmund had the look of one who had been with the witch and had eaten her food. You can always tell them, says Mr. Beaver, if you've lived long enough in Narnia, something about their eyes. Second example, from the silver chair with Prince Rillian, a prince who has gone missing and children have been summoned by Aslan to go on a quest to look for him with Puddleglum the Marshwiggle. Prince Rillian from the silver chair also has such a transformation revealed in his face. While he initially is transformed in a negative way upon the disappearance of his mother, a change confirmed by the look in his eyes, writes Lewis, his positive transformation is revealed later using similar features. While he is yet under the spell of the lady in the green kirtle, Lewis writes that he looks both bold and kind, though there was something about his face that didn't seem quite right. Upon destroying the chair, however, this something wrong, whatever it was, had vanished from his face. In Horse and His Boy, Shasta's transformation is connected with his face as well. Left behind by faster riders from Arkenland who are going to pursue to the Caramarine soldiers who are preparing ambush, Shasta is left to find a pass through the mountains between Arkenland and Narnia. Aslan intervenes, however, providing a way in the darkness, eventually illuminating the way by his own radiance. Lewis writes, after one glance at the lion's face, Shasta slipped out of the saddle and fell at his feet. Here, Shasta becomes speechless, and Lewis emphasizes the point, writing, he couldn't say anything, but then he didn't want to say anything, and he knew he needn't say anything. This is noteworthy because no less than five times earlier in the story, Shasta is told to be quiet. Upon seeing the face of Aslan, he is a different person. And Shasta's face is included as the transformation is completed. Upon Aslan's mysterious departure after leading Shasta through the pass, Shasta wonders if it was all a dream. But of course it isn't. Proof is the enormous paw print that eventually produced a well and spring of water, which Shasta uses to wash his face, be refreshed, and understand how he passaged safely through the mountains. He has been transformed. And he has been transformed to be silent, and he is now observant. A final example of this transformation is from The Magician's Nephew with the first king and queen of Narnia, Frank and Helen. They are revealed to be new characters, a people of new character, by their faces. Lewis writes, neither hair nor clothes that made them look so different from their own old selves. Their faces had a new expression, especially the king's. All the sharpness and cunning and quarrelsomeness which he had picked up as a London cabbie seemed to have been washed away, and the courage and kindness which had always been there were easier to see. Perhaps it was the air of the young world that had done it, or talking with Aslan, or both. The completion of this transformation, or the extent of the completion of this transformation, is then confirmed by the cabbie's old horse, Fledge, who has now become a winged horse, and he says, My old master's been changed nearly as much as I have. He's a real master now. Summing this section up, what we see from Lewis is that the face becomes that which reveals the unshowable. It often stands in for the self, revealing what otherwise is hidden and revealing transformation that the reader would not otherwise know so clearly. So, how might these insights from the Chronicles of Narnia apply to our questions of self-revelation and pastoral leadership? Number one, we might have a gentle challenge to any sense of self-idolatry in the self-revelation of the pastor, because it is Aslan's face that is saving. While other faces influence, as we'll see in a moment, it's Aslan's face which is ultimately the site of saving and judgment. At the end of the last battle, all creatures, without any other option, must look, quote, straight in Aslan's face, and their fate is revealed in the hatred and fear, or the love, though with fright, expressed in their faces in response to Aslan's own face. Second, we might have a caution that pastors, along with others, truly are influencers, even if we try to hide ourselves. The White Witch, who is the queen in The Magician's Nephew, influenced Edmund to look like her. And the chief of police, Mogrim, or Fenris Ulf, in an earlier edition of Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, are both said to have these red mouths. Her authenticity was effective in influencing others. Uncle Andrew, as well, Diggory's uncle, is one who influences through his own self-revelation, authentic as he is. He says, "You must learn, child, that we would be wrong for you. It would be wrong for you or any of the common people is not wrong for such a great queen or for me." And indeed, Diggory becomes one who considers putting himself beyond the rules, just like his uncle, his uncle Andrew did. Third, mask wearers must be mindful of the fact that there is a self or a face that is beneath the mask. Here I want to delve deeply into Till We Have Faces. In the story Till We Have Faces, Orwell is a character who dons a mask in order to become the Queen of Gloam. She's this hideously ugly woman, and she deals with this by putting this mask on her face. After a time, she writes, "The Queen of Gloam had more and more part of me, and Orwell had less and less." So she becomes more and more one character and less herself because of the mask she wears. The mask donned by Orwell changed herself. Ultimately, this loss of self is revealed when Orwell stands before the gods, which, if you know the story, is exactly what she wants. But in so doing, she finally realizes that she has become blind to herself. Orwell writes, "How can the gods meet us face to face until we have faces? Or how can we know the gods as selves until we know ourselves, or we have a self, our self?" Underneath the mask that Orwell wears, there is less and less a self. And in fact, what ends up happening is she gorges herself on the selves of other people. Now, this ends up being a tension, because for Orwell, this wearing of the mask is actually quite helpful for her in the reign that she has. She describes her reign as a queen in these terms. And it's important when I'm going to use this description, she's a reliable witness at this point. She isn't always a reliable witness, but at this point in the story, what she shares is reliable. It has a ring of truth, in part because it is so humble. Orwell describes herself as more and more the queen, and yes, less and less Orwell, but to these benefits. She says that she was a good queen, though she had two very good counselors. She does not glamorize her reign. It's, in fact, a rather humble account. Rather than accepting praise that the public bestows on her, she records a much more chastened reality. So the sense of humility, the sense of giving credit to honor, makes her this reliable witness. But she describes her reign like this. She says that my second strength in leadership lay in my veil, or this mask. I could never have believed, till I had proof of it, what it would do for me. From the very first, it began that night in the garden with Trunia. As soon as my face was invisible, people began to discover all manner of beauties about my voice. In the persona created by the mask, the reader sees that Orwell changes the culture of the palace by hanging an unjust, scheming busybody. She sets slaves free, facilitates their marriages, provides them land and cottages to make a life, and inspires their deep loyalty. She develops systems of economic prosperity and social justice. She finds education for her counselors and enables the building of a noble library. Orwell's just, caring, and fruitful leadership is facilitated by her mask. In a brief, though similar event, at the end of the last battle, Lewis writes this of King Tyrion. You would not have known from Tyrion's face that he had now given up all hope. He masks his true self in order to continue engaging in leadership. Both Orwell and Tyrion performed admirably and appropriately by masking their faces, literally and emotionally. Now, some of the challenge of this is that the negative impact that this has on Orwell. At one point, as she's been wearing her mask for so long, it says that she's more recognizable with the mask than without it. Legends among the people grow about just what face is beneath Orwell's mask. Some say there's a great beauty or a great terror. Some say there's an animal's face. Orwell herself writes, "The best story was that I had no face at all. If you stripped off my veil, you'd find emptiness." In so writing, Orwell has written more than she knows, because truly beneath this mask, there was no self. While her role as queen was facilitated and performed admirably at times, there was a loss of self as to who Orwell was. What Orwell will later come to name of herself is that rather than being so selfless, she interprets a story to be one without any self. She engorges the selves of others and takes their lives into her, especially her counselors. Lewis, we can surmise, would be a proponent of wearing masks to a certain extent, but also to the importance of de-rolling or taking off the masks from time to time in order to be face-to-face with God and face-to-face with others whom we trust. Willimon shares some of this wisdom back in the book Pastor when he writes, "When too much energy is expended in keeping up this mask, when there is no chance to move out of the role, take off the mask, and let down our image, there's a fundamental disjunction between who we are and the role that we play." All right. So to sum up some of my findings on this question here, what might Lewis tell me? I think he would say, at times you need to wear a mask. At times you need to be mindful of covering over part of who you are. At the same time, you need to have people around whom you can take the mask off. If you only wear a mask, you become one who doesn't have a self. You become only a masked person under whom there is nothing. As I reflected on this with pastoral ministry, I think there are certainly times when it is tempting simply to put on the mask of being strong and capable and all things going well in order to service our people, which is good, and yet something as well to be very wary of, something to be leery of, and to be self-critical. Are we constantly wearing a mask, or do we have people around whom we can take the mask off? Are we displaying that mask before God, or are we being our authentic selves before Him as well? I think that's it.